Oh, hey everybody. It's Christian. And this is another Bright Side podcast. So today I've got a special guest. I went all the way back to Cal State LA and got a hold of a professor, Dr. Enrique Ochoa, who's a really interesting guy and fun guy to talk to. He's a professor of history and Latin American studies there. He's has a very activist spirit, and he's very enthusiastic and charismatic. So, really good guy to just learn from and just ask questions and just find out what his opinions are. I was fortunate enough to have him on the podcast. We were kind of on a time crunch, so he moves really fast. So you'll catch on to that. And basically, we didn't have enough time to cover the topic that I wanted to and other topics very well. But we covered a small little portion, which I think, gives you a good idea of what I was trying to do. But I got him to talk about neocolonialism, globalization, and we also talked about the current political climate in the current presidential race for 2016. And, he also told and talked about, the strike that's happening at the Cal State system here in California. The strike's going to be happening April 13th. So, look out for that. So without further ado, Dr. Enrique Ochoa. Hey, Dr. Ochoa, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you doing, Chris?
Pretty good. I haven't seen you in so long. It's been quite a while. I wanted to have you on to talk about just, your field of study, what you do here, but also get to know a little bit about you. Mm-hmm. So go ahead and tell us, who are you? Where'd you grow up?
Sure. My name is Enrique Ochoa. I teach history and Latin American studies here at Cal State Los Angeles. I've been here about 20 years. Before that, I taught Cal State Dominguez Hills, UCLA, a few other places around the area. I was born and raised right around this area in LA, in the Eastern San Gabriel Valley and La Puente and Hacienda Heights.
So, like around the East LA area mainly?
Yeah, further east actually, the eastern part of the county. So more out in San Gabriel Valley, more out. Kind of the eastern part, near Pomona, Whittier.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I know that. I grew up more in the South Bay area, like Hermosa, San Pedro, Gardena, Carson, all that.
Yeah, yeah.
You went to school at UCLA?
Yeah, so I have my doctorate and my master's and bachelor's all from UCLA. Before that, I went to Mount San Antonio Community College, mm-hmm. and for a brief period of time, I was at the Military Academy at West Point.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
No, luckily it didn't last long.
Oh, okay.
It was a good learning experience.
All right. So you got into history and Latin American study. How'd that become your thing? Or what interested you? Was it high school or something you saw?
You know, I was raised to teach. I was raised by middle school teachers to teach, and again, history and Latin American studies were kind of a lot of the discussion around the household. I mean, my mother and father, my mother was a middle school teacher, my father as well. They met here at Cal State LA. They met in the Spanish class.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so they were both very interested in studying Spanish and Latin America. My father's Nicaragüense, and so when they graduated, they went out to the eastern part of the valley and they found jobs teaching Spanish. My mother taught Spanish, my father social studies, and so really it was just kind of how we lived. In many ways I didn't even conceive of another profession.
Wow.
And then they were kind of, since they were both first generation and had very difficult time getting through, their notion was, you can go as far as you want and we're gonna support you. We're gonna and so they told both, you know, my sister and I that, and just kind of put us on the track. So once we graduated, you know, we didn't have to, you know, they supported it. And again, that was a time in the 1980s when California was far more generous than it is now, and really, you know, believed in what they set up in the 1960s in the master plan to have colleges, you know, college and university is relatively inexpensive. And so still it meant a couple second mortgages on their house and like, but nevertheless, that was their commitment. They said, no, we're going to push you through. And so I was able to go straight through, which is, you know, extremely
difficult.
Fortunate.
Yeah.
Not really difficult. I mean, it's difficult, yes, but fortunate because I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have to work as much as they did.
Yeah.
And again, I guess being a Latino raised in this area, especially the time when I was raised in the 70s and 80s, in which there was a lot of people, especially where I was raised, there was a lot of movement of people from the east side to the suburbs, and a lot of erasing of people's identity going on. And so the people were becoming increasingly anglicized and not really connected to the roots, and really assimilating and kind of forced to assimilate in a rather harsh way, and then internalizing and assimilating as well. And so, you know, my father was from Nicaragua, and in school, when people would always ask me, you know, where are your parents from? I would say Nicaragua, and they would look at me like, oh, that must be Nigeria, that must be somewhere in Africa.
No,
they
way.
Had no idea where that was.
Today, you can't even get away with that, right? I mean, everybody knows an idea of where Nicaragua is, right?
I don't know about that. Definitely more do because Fred, the larger Central American population, but not everywhere, but especially not then. Mm. I venture to say even the teachers did not know.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, that always kind of stuck in my mind, and then just kind of hearing what was going on. I mean, I always would hear about history quite a bit, and I would hear about stuff going on in Mexico, but also with the Nicaraguan Revolution in the 1970s, I would hear quite a bit of my grandparents, although they were here. They would be talking about their relatives in Nicaragua fighting on both sides, the difficulty they were facing, and all that kind of interested me. It was a search for who I was, an identity search, and also just kind of seeing the family troubles, but not being able to know much about it. And so that led me to ask questions with my parents and to receive a lot of lectures.
Wow, that's I didn't know that. That's interesting. Did they want you to go to UCLA or did they want you to come here at Cal State LA?
So to school, it was that's an interesting question. I think my father always was thinking about UCLA, that, you know, if you go to UCLA, that was more prestigious and the like. I didn't get into UCLA, so that counted that out. At least initially, out of high school, I did.
Oh, okay.
And then but I was heavily recruited, not unlike recruiters do these days on high school campuses. I was heavily recruited for the military and to go to the military academy at West Point. So I was kind of targeted and honed in, and, you know, like military recruiters do. Although again, it's kind of a little different than regular military recruiters, but, you know, they cultivate you and they make you feel as if you're special and important, and they suck you in.
Yeah, they do.
In ways that other schools weren't doing to me.
At the time,
that was not happening, right. And then there was a certain lure of it, even though, again, I came from a very anti-militarist family, very progressive family as well, and... But I was able to rationalize it. I had known a fair amount of Latin American history at the time, and I knew there were all kinds of left wing generals and people in the military that were members of the Communist Party, and so I reconciled it, and so I ended up going, which I think upset my mother, in particular, since she knew what it meant. She knew what it meant to be in the military, and in terms of U.S. imperialism and the like, her critique was there, although she held her tongue. But luckily, I flunked out, you know, of several classes. So the decision was made for me. But I knew very quickly I didn't fit. I mean, right? That's another place where I began to become more Latino, okay. and identify more Latino than I was previously. Even though I was always looking for things and asking questions, but because of the overarching presence of whiteness and the kind of very East Coast masculinist normative behavior, you know, I quickly felt out of sorts. It's a heavily Christian environment as well as all the U.S. is, and I was raised an atheist, and so it was very so I began to look for my identity pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And that's where I began to again look at it and analyze, and even in classes I was not able to really express myself in a way that was true to who I was. So even writing papers, I remember, poorly written papers that all deserved Fs. But they, you know, if I wasn't writing about God and duty and country, you know, there was really nothing else they wanted to hear. Mm. And none of those things really mean much to me.
It's like a group think mentality.
Very much so. And so if I would write off the top of my head, I would write things about gun control, or I would, very liberal things of the day, or I would write about U.S. policy towards Cuba with a little critique of it.
You were just stabbing at him?
No. Maybe. Maybe, subconsciously. But oftentimes, that's what I knew.
Yeah.
That's what I knew, and so I was called out several times as being, I was being too ostentatious. I was trying to show that I knew something. I was trying to push buttons. And no, I really wasn't. I was just being who I was.
Mm.
But, it wasn't tolerated. So luckily, I was out of there. But with the sense of really knowing kind of where I wanted to go, having learned a lot there about how U.S. society works, about the military, about many different really aspects, I knew I wanted to study more and focus in on history and explore this other side of the U.S.
Okay. Wow, that's an interesting turnaround. How old were you when you got?
I was 17. Yeah, I graduated. I started at West Point when I was 17.
Wow,
almost
18. That's young. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was a kid. I mean, but then again, that's how recruitment works, right? It kind of gets you before you knew who you fully are. Mm-hmm.
And so when you came back and you were trying to figure yourself out, how old were you then?
Then I was only, 18.
Oh, you were only there for a year.
Literally, it was 7 months, 8 months. Yeah.
Okay.
It was eight months.
All right. So you learned quick.
Right. So I learned quickly, and then I knew, I didn't do well academically. I need to, get down, and I have to study, and I threw myself into it, and the more I was doing it, it was the history classes that were the more exciting ones, mm-hmm. even though it was Western civilization and U.S. history and some of the European history, which was I was interested in. Mm-hmm. But at that point, I began to want to look for more, and I began to read on my own to a degree in which I had done a little bit before, but I was never, reading always came difficult for me. It was always mm-hmm. difficult for me, but that's when I began. First, second year of college, to begin to read books kind of on my own, and as I did, I was drawn to Latin American history and Latin American studies and revolutionary studies in particular.
You mentioned that you came from a family that already knew about the American imperialism mm-hmm. and empire and stuff. Let's go back to that a little bit mm-hmm. and let's talk about the question of what is globalization right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we live in a world where we have the internet, telephones, mm-hmm. Pictures, everything's digital, mm-hmm. Satellites. I mean, what is globalization?
Yeah, that's a big question. It's a big question, and it could be, I guess you can see it in a lot of different ways, but really it's this global expansion of capitalism that's kind of boomed really over the past, since World War II, but especially since the 1970s and 1980s, where capital, which before was focusing more on national development of national industries, but with the shifts of the global economy, have really expanded overseas in many different ways. Not just importing, exporting, but to create a kind of a global labor market and a global market as a whole. And as capital, which has been kind of expanding and developing over the past, 200 or 300 or 400 years, depends how we count it. Each year, it's exponential in its growth, and so really, over the past 3 or 4 decades, we've seen this whole major digital revolution that taken us to a stage that one could not have fathomed really years ago. And a lot of that has to do with the growth of financial capital and the ability to break down those barriers in terms of trade barriers and other barriers to incorporate large sectors of the third world, the developing world, large sectors of the world into the global market. So in general, that's what it is, right? One could see it also as an expansion of, colonialism and capitalist expansion and colonialism and imperialism kind of on steroids to a degree that again, couldn't have been fathomed in 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, or even, in 1898 when the U.S. was at war with Spain and took over Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Philippines. Now it's at a much greater scale.
Would it be considered? Is it good? I mean, is it bad?
Well, I wouldn't put it in terms of
good or bad.
Well, maybe I would. I think it all depends on
what end you're on,
and to who we're asking. It all depends who we're asking. I mean, let's put it this way. Really, what it's leading to is a radical transformation in the ways of lives of people all over the world. And again, a lot of that has already happened in the U.S. over the past, since the late 19th century, people transforming, where they live and how they live and what they do. And a lot of that by the middle of the 20th century had already happened, where people, whereas 80 years before, people knew the food they knew where it came from, Either they grew it directly or they knew where it came. They had a relationship with that cow that they would eat, or the chickens. There was a connection. But as in the late 19th century, as we industrialized, that kind of dislocation, that kind of expansion, where we then became disassociated with those things, and maybe moved to other places, and were involved in work that our parents didn't do, but began to do other things. Right, that whole transformation had taken place in the U.S. It hadn't taken place everywhere, and so in that period of 130 years or so, 150 years of U.S. industrialization, that transformation dislocated a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Now, it did it in a way that, over time, people were able to relocate in certain ways and to find some niche, but it did it in a way that also expanded inequality. Again, a heavily interventionist government for the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, slowed that down. The federal government from the Roosevelt up until the 1960s, I invested a lot of money then.
The New Deals, new social programs.
Exactly. Through the social programs and through a very stiff tax structure, where the wealthy were taxed at a very high rate, on the order that they were becoming wealthy. They were doing well because they had workers, they had a larger structure and infrastructure, community, all of which was generated from not just their work, from everyone's work. And so it was their duty to kind of pay that back in, and that would, as you said, to create social programs, to increase the number of people who are working, to build colleges and universities, all of which then are as a social investment, but it's also an economic investment to increase people's social capital and cultural capital, so that they can then work at higher levels. And as that was occurring, so there was a lot of dislocation, but it was also buffered by a lot. By the 1970s and 1980s, with the growing movement towards a neoliberalism, towards a movement away, really cutting that old social expenditure, kind of a neoconservatism is what we called it here, but heavily associated with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, this move towards neoliberalism was trying to bring back the laissez-faire 19th century liberalism, arguing that the government really was the obstacle here, and it wasn't helping people, and it wasn't building it, and it was instead stifling economic growth, right? And as that discussion began to happen, by the 70s, it was a very fringe discussion, just talked about by a few very fringe folks. But by the 70s and 80s, it increasingly became more of a mainstream conversation in economics departments, in politics, and then began to infect or infiltrate, if you will, into the political system. And that notion was that the market really was the ultimate fair arbiter, right? And this market fundamentalism that emerged then really began to wage war, and has been helped to wage war, used to wage war against the public sector and the social safety net and the public good, so to speak. And that's been happening in the U.S., so there's been increased dislocation. But at the same time, right, then it's that notion of globalization, that one that's more market-driven, where there's not a lot of investment and effort to create a social safety net. It's that market fundamentalism that then is kind of pushed overseas, if you will, in this more recent phase of globalization. It's that kind of, right, through the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, it's that kind of, you know, movement of trying to integrate these other countries in as markets, and at the same time trying to open up again lands and open up lands and gut what little social safety that they have as a way of trying to create more potential workers.
Do you think that's, I know this is probably not, but do you think that's done in a very truistic way? Like altruistic way, or do you think it's done primarily for greed, or a little combination of? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to say a combination of both, but a little bit more where, well, this is what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. More of like as if they have a cause.
Right. Yes, I mean that's a tricky one, right? Is it about greed, and I would argue no, it's about the logic of capital, mm-hmm. and it's about an ideological system that is surrounding it. As kind of a Western ideological system that's surrounding it and that is justifying it and that sees itself as very benevolent. And so it's a combination of those things. The argument is that, no, this is the logic of capital. We have to go overseas. And, of course, capital is the... capital and capitalism and capitalist growth is the... What? Is the way, right? There is no other alternative. And especially, again, with the bankruptcy of the Soviet Union, the bankruptcy of multiple levels, the Soviet Union, and then the crash of the Soviet Union, and the so-called end of socialisms, of actually existing socialisms, which never really were actually existing socialisms, but nevertheless, then there became this notion of really, yeah, that there is one way, right? The Margaret Thatcher notion of TINA, there is no other alternative. Mm-hmm. But that was shrouded, and it's been shrouded, especially in the U.S., around this very liberal notion of trying to uplift people, shrouded as well, if you will, in kind of a white supremacist notion or racial superiority notion that we know what's good for society, and this is what's good for society. Even though, of course, workers and farmers and many other people are resisting it in the U.S., but at the ideological level, there's this larger sense that no, this is good, and we're going to kind of make you believe it's good, and it happens in so many different ways, through the media, through books, through schooling process, the internalization of it.
Do you think that would be, I mean, capitalism or the perspective of capitalism? Because I mean, if you go back to Adam Smith, mm-hmm. He's all about the invisible hand, right. And of course, a lot of people, economists, would probably argue that the capitalistic way is probably not the most efficient, but mm-hmm. it's the most equal, mm-hmm. if it's done altruistically, of course,
right.
correctly. And today, and I'm pretty sure a lot of students, you yourself, would probably say that we aren't in capitalism right now. Mm-hmm. We're more in I'm missing the vocab, but definitely there's a lot more lobbyists, there's a lot mm-hmm. more special interests that have right. much more, almost as if it was a fascist way,
right?
In some form.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, so I see where you're going, because you're to. I mean, it's still definitely capitalism. It's not that atomistic notion of capitalism of kind of small firms being kind of
small.
Exactly. Because the logic of capitalists such that, right, in order to survive, they need to grow. And then when they need to grow, they have to find ways to keep growing and find ways of protecting themselves or protecting their shareholders and the
like an organism, pretty much.
Exactly. And in the process, the lobbying, of course, cut back significant numbers of regulation, amount of regulation, so that allowed them to grow even more in ways that are relatively largely unregulated, really. Much of the regulation is being done by people who used to be in that industry and no longer are, and kind of go in and out through the revolving door. So the logic of it is to see this growth, right? This oligopolistic growth in many cases, where you just have a few firms kind of controlling. If you don't have a regulatory agency to limit growth, which again is contrary to the market, the argument would be, you're going to have then oligopolistic or monopolistic tendencies down at some point down the road, and they're always going to be working to strengthen their interests, to protect themselves, to get lobbies, especially if there are no limits on lobbying and the like, and so it's always going to have, I don't want to say that corrupting influence, but it's definitely going to have that influence of really protecting themselves, because really it's an interest group, it's a class that's working to protect itself. And it sees its class interest, and in the process is defining its class interest, right, as also the public interest.
Yeah.
And so that seeps over, right? They get very adept at that discourse, where I guess it's really been only the past 7 or 8 years, this whole notion of, no, they're not big corporations, they're job creators, right? And this notion of, no, I'm a job creator, and because I'm a job creator, I know how to do a payroll, and therefore I'm more apt to do it. So right, that's about the transforming of the discourse and the ideological kind of perspectives towards prioritizing that notion of the private sector and the value of the private sector over the public sector and over the collective good. And this notion that they're job creators and therefore it shouldn't be touched politically, because that's what they do. And that's a slippery slope. I mean, that's a transformation. So as you said, going back, right, that's I think that's a lot of the logic of capital. But it also plays into, I think, a larger ideological notion of, and I guess you can see this way back in the 19th century with Manifest Destiny, right? Manifest Destiny and folks coming and expanding and the U.S. government growing and taking over, right? The Louisiana Purchase and then invading Mexico and taking half northern Mexico. And it was about expanding markets, definitely. It was about these growing companies on the East Coast needing more markets and needing more places to get inputs, and then right by.
But definitely, that was more driven of just power driven, right? I mean that was a blatant example of, oh, this is mine now, and you know.
I would say they're connected, right? Because the power of the U.S. government was rather small. I mean, yes, it was growing during the 20s and 30s and 40s, but it was relatively small and weak until it began to, until it was kind of pushed by entrepreneurs and other and capitalists begin to find more areas, right? And begin to expand, begin to figure out places to expand to able to accommodate a growing economy that needs, right? And it needs more food and other, and taking over the Midwest and then beginning to again plow under the various forests to right. That's driven, I would say it's driven by the power of capital and its ability to again lobby the government and maybe take over the government in different ways. I don't mean take over fully. but capture it in a certain ways, because those in government, right, can also are part of that revolving door in different ways. And so I would say, right, that expansion that we begin to see back then wasn't just about the economic growth and power, as you indicate. I mean, it was about that, but it's also couched in not just manifest destiny, it's couched in the notion of mission. It is our duty as civilized people, as Americans, in quotes, as people who know, who are God-fearing people. So there's a Christian notion, a missionary aspect to it, but there's also kind of a white man's burden notion. Again, much of this is, remember, in the middle 19th century, early late 19th century, a period of the growth of eugenics and a belief of certain, right, certain races are more powerful than others and are better adept at doing things. So a lot of the missionary impulse was, well, it's our duty to uplift these backward societies of what was once Mexico and now is the United States, the indigenous people, the Mexicanos, the mestizo Mexicanos, who were from, in this perspective, who were from two different races and were mixed, and therefore had degraded both races through their mixture, had weakened the race. And there are all kinds of testimonies and all kinds of travel writing from people on the East Coast, you know, hearing about this wondrous but yet dangerous land of Mexico and now the U.S. West, and these primitive people who are kind of interesting, but are backwards, and the men are dangerous and scary, and the women are beautiful and exotic, right? This whole kind of construction of this, and it's our duty then to go and to help bring up these backwards folks and teach them how to be civilized, and that sense of missionariness, right, is very embedded in the foundation, I think, of the U.S.
Even today.
I mean,
the Bush doctrine, right? I mean, was sort of like that.
That's right. I mean, when Bush was talking, when the oil companies and Halliburton, right, was all in the Bush administration and all that, and they were definitely pushing it. But there is also a sense in those folks that it is about, right, liberating people and bringing freedom and democracy, and I put those words in quotes, meaning the market system. Meaning, right, free individuals not connected to their communities or whatever ways, but this notion of our way of life is the best way, right? And then you hear it all the time, right? And not just on Fox News, you hear it, right? Even Democrats say it in different ways, but this is the best nation, it's the greatest nation that God ever gave us. Again, right, not even debating, not debating that at all, but just the notion of that is a sense of superiority, yeah. American exceptionalism, that then it's our duty to promote, to bring to Syria, to bring to Libya, to bring to the world.
So, I mean, just to play devil's advocate here, please. All right.
Although I like the devil, so.
Oh, do you? So let's say for George Bush, right? I mean, he had that notion, and he would argue. Let's take, for example, the AIDS epidemic that's happening in Africa. Mm-hmm. You know, some people would say, isn't it good that we're intervening in there and giving them medicine and, you know, using our money to, mm-hmm. you know, build hospitals and infrastructure to better help right. Africans? I mean, isn't that in a way it could be considered neocolonialism in some way?
So it could be both. It could be seen as, right, potentially, right, benevolent of us going and helping the situation, and then it could also be seen as, well, is that the reason we're doing it, right? What and so it's always a question of intention, right? What's the intention? So why is it okay? Why does the U.S. then intervene in certain natural disasters or in certain so-called genocidal, sometimes really genocidal yeah. situations, and not in others? Right? Why invade people? Right? A lot of discussion about. I heard my congressman earlier talking about the potential genocide of Christian folks in Iraq and ISIS and Syria, right? And that discussion. Well, why intervene in that genocide and not in the Rwanda ones? Right? The question of intention is, I think, very important here. Can Can the U.S. go? Should the U.S. be going everywhere? Is a question.
Okay.
And then why in certain areas and not in other areas, and in which ways? So I would say, yeah, definitely there are important aspects of an important responsibility as world citizens. Okay, not always the
very
way
very broad.
It would be framed, but to help out right in these crises. But the question always is why in certain areas and why in others. There's obviously some political there's political calculation in that, and there's political calculus in that. There's certain areas are deemed to have more worth strategically.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets to the real question. Okay, well, then why is there really intervention going on? So I think there's that aspect. I mean, yes, it's not that the U.S. shouldn't be and could be doing well. However, it has to ask the question from back. Well, why are situations economies deteriorating to the extent, right, that outbreaks of a variety of diseases are occurring? Is it just a function of just this naturally happens? And the answer is no, there are no real natural disasters. I mean, yes, there are natural disasters,
yeah.
But it's not natural how it affects populations.
Okay.
So a hurricane can come and destroy Haiti and also hit Cuba hard, and Haiti will see, right, tens of thousands of people displaced, and if not hundreds of thousands of people displaced, and tens of thousands of killed. And in Cuba, well, some will be impacted, but not many really will be killed. Well, a lot of that has to do with the infrastructure, mm-hmm. right? And what's built and what's been invested in. So that, again, even though U.S. aid has gone, there's been a significant amount of U.S. aid going to Haiti, it doesn't get there because that's the goal isn't to build it up and to improve people's lives.
Yeah.
It might be about, yes, trying to deal with this epidemic, and it also might indirectly be about trying to trying to prop up a certain kind of stability for potential business to be able to invest in. But it's not necessarily about improving the lives of folks, because if you do that, you then talk to folks. You don't just talk to the leaders, and you don't just, right, you engage a broader conversation.
Yeah.
So a lot of the people that have been, if you will, displaced, right, which is rapidly occurring through all kinds of land grabs and displacements through this rapid globalization in the global south, you know, they haven't been consulted. They haven't been asked, would you rather be eating McDonald's, or would you rather be eating,
I don't know,
any kind of packaged fast food stuff instead of your traditional food stuff? You know, would you rather be? Yes, there definitely are some advantages and connections that you might want to have. It's, you want to be on the internet, you want to connect and see your family abroad, but does everything have to change for you to be able to do that?
Mm.
And so I think, you know, a lot of it, because it's not done in a democratic process, and again, we can ask, when have anything been done on a democratic process? But it's devastating, right? Whole communities.
Well, they're process. Like,
and it's not doing much benefit for us either.
Yeah. Well,
although
we can
have this podcast.
Yeah.
but people are working much longer here, right? Many more
it's
hours
a lot more
than
stressful here. Yeah, and I mean, definitely you can see the deterioration of culture in other countries. For mm-hmm. instance, I mean, one off the top of my head, a very good example would be Italy, Rome. You know, I went there and checked out the Pantheon. It had this beautiful, great structure, and right across the street from it, there's a McDonald's. Mm-hmm. You know, part of the same little circle that, you know, thousands of years of architecture and education has been piled onto, and there's McDonald's right there. It just takes it away.
Exactly.
Not to say that, you know, people from Rome don't deserve a McDonald's, but I mean, come on, you know,
yeah.
It's not my favorite thing.
That's right.
Another thing is, in third world countries, you're seeing the obviously what is the result of neocolonialism is companies coming in and buying as much land as possible, using that land for one specific resource, and I mean just taking away all these resources, and it's not even for the people. Like for instance, the country Belize right now.
Mm-hmm.
One of their, I think, the number one or number two of their main resources for GDP was sugarcane.
Mm-hmm.
And sugarcane was primarily a Belizean industry. And I think either last year or the year before, it officially isn't no longer in Belizean industry. All the for the exception of one company, all of the companies are either U.S. or Canadian. Mm-hmm. What, I mean, how can people over there help themselves if their own government is striking these deals? Mm-hmm. I mean, what? I mean, I'm pretty sure that is the definition of colonialism, right?
Right. Yeah. No, it definitely is. Right. This is definitely, as you say, a neo-colonial situation, and a lot of the rules, a lot of the trade rules with through the IMF and the World Bank and through the WTO, the World Trade Organization, has created a situation where it's rather difficult, right, for local governments to, if you will, protect their industries, the local industries, mm-hmm. right? To sign on to these various ones, it's about opening up their industries, opening up their markets that in the past they've protected, because they said, no, this is a national industry and there's a national social, not just economic, benefit for us having this. And in the case of Mexico, you know, maize, growing corn, right? This is the staple of the country, so it's important to produce, to lift to raise the tariff barriers, to subsidize the production of it, because it isn't just feeding the population, but it's also being produced by large numbers of indigenous people and campesinos who historically have done this, right? And for a long time, that was, again, not very well. Protected, but it was protected for a long time until the 80s, when they said no, as part of, again, these structural adjustment programs with the IMF and the World Bank and the neoliberalism, and then later on with the WTO, the Mexican corn market, the maize market, needs to be open. And so large numbers of Midwestern firms and Cargill and ADM and large agribusiness then should be able to sell their maize there. And in effect, they've been dumping it, really. And we've been able to do it in such large quantities that's further hurt the small Mexican farmer. Mm. And in the process, right, forced many to migrate and to come to the U.S., which again is an important function of, right, this form of, but again, it's happening at a very rapid pace of capitalist globalization, okay, about pushing people out of backward industries and encouraging them to then work in modern industries, right? And that means and the construction is agriculture is backward industry.
Yeah.
Even though, of course, it's what people have been doing for thousands of years, and that's the structure of their lives and their ways of looking at the world, and that it's not just, and again, in the case of Mexico, the notion is, well, it's not just, people weren't just growing maize. It wasn't just a crop. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a commodity.
It was a livelihood.
It was a livelihood, and it was a way of life, and it was a connection of people to the land and to the broader world in many ways, right? A lot of, again, and you can see this in Mexica culture, you can see it in Mayan culture, right? People identify themselves. If you look at the Popol Vuh, the Mayan Book of Life, people, the gods in the book tried to first create people out of sticks. They didn't like it. They then say, hey, well, let's try this other way where they're less wooden. We can, you know, use some maize dough, nixtamal, and make people out of maize dough. And then they say, hey, we like this. And then let's bake them for a while, and bake some light, some dark, some redder, some yellower, and lo and behold, you have the formation of humans, right, in the Mayan Book of Life. Again, whether that literally happened or not, right, but it sets the world view of how people see themselves connected to the world. And so people are literally, you know, hombres and mujeres de maíz. Mm. They're really people of maize. And so all of a sudden, when you very rapidly say, no, that's backwards, don't grow that. And in the process, of course, you know, there are companies coming down to teach you how to do it in more efficient ways and hybridize corn. And then later on, of course, you know, genetically modify it. You're really pushing out a way of life. right? Yeah. It's really, one could argue, without exaggeration, it is about a cultural genocide to a certain degree. It's about a way of people, the people have done things and how they knew, and so that all the different, the hundreds and sometimes even, I think even thousands of different strains of corn and types of corn and how people would save the seed and then...
Well, there's hardly any organic corn at all now, right?
It's virtually impossible to get. It's very difficult. That's right. Of course, those seeds are still, they exist somewhere, but they're in seed banks that are, you know, patented by Monsanto.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
and places that are very difficult. And they are in the hands of small farmers and former farmers. But it's very difficult to grow.
What about the argument that, I mean, a little bit of a change, but sure. What about the argument pro Monsanto, sorry to shift it a bit, sure. But that, you know, by doing GMO products, we are now capable of actually feeding the population of the world. I mean, that there is more food abundantly for at least third world countries.
Right.
Ironically, we are, you know, sourcing out those resources, but now we got, you know, bags of rice and stuff.
That's right. Well, yeah, and that's an interesting argument, right? And that has been the traditional argument, right? That the greater the production, the more likely it is to drive down the price, and that is going to be able to to feed more people because they'll have access through the market. Yeah, that really hasn't borne out as of yet. I mean, it doesn't mean that we don't have more food. There definitely is more food, and even in the first Green Revolution. In the from 40s to 1960s, where the U.S. Department of Agriculture, in connection with the Rockefeller Foundation, hired a bunch of corn breeders and wheat breeders to find strains that could grow in different areas, that produced an abundant amount of corn and wheat in Mexico, for example, and a fairly abundant amount in India. Now, it didn't, however. Didn't mean that everyone got access to food, right? Poverty rates and malnutrition rates did not change.
Yeah.
And at this point in time, they're not changing. Even though there's growing wealth, for example, given the example of Mexico, there's growing wealth and there's the growth of all these, again, Monsanto in Mexico and many other very large agribusinesses involved, Cargill being one, ADM, right? The major players, in addition to Walmart being there and Mexico having a couple of the largest food companies that exist on the planet of the earth, right? The largest baker and bakery goods producer is Bimbo, and that's a Mexican company. And Bimbo owns Sara Lee, it owns Roman Meal. It's kind of all the bread we eat in the U.S. is pretty much Bimbo under different names. And it's the number one baker in the world and the fourth largest food company in the world as well. Large, right? Tortilla producer is Mexican Gruma. Maseca, which produces tortillas and other flatbreads and has factories in India now and in Pakistan and all over the world. He's a globe. So there's a significant amount of
food
produced and packaged produced food being sold. However, it's not getting everywhere. And some would argue that it's not all food.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. That is packaged and processed in such a way that is then adding not just to malnutrition and the traditional malnutrition in which people don't have enough to eat, but it's also creating other malnutrition aspects like obesity and type 2 diabetes, which of course in Mexico is on the rise because it's much cheaper in many cases to buy a Coke and eat potato chips than it is to get rice and beans.
It's
much more accessible in many of these stores, the Walmarts and well, not just Walmarts, but also in the small neighborhood stores, because the big packaged food companies they have those routes. They're able to get there because of their marketing and their production skills.
But also their grand, you know, how grand they are. They can actually export. They have the money to and capital to do so.
That's right. It's scale.
Yeah.
It's scale, and so that's the logic of capital. It's the question of scale, and in the process, that pushes out the production of small bean producers and again other producers who in the past sustain families, and so that makes it difficult to eat well in these areas unless you're middle class and upper middle class, and it's not much different here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's easy to get fast food. You know, you can get the dollar meal at McDonald's and you can feed a family of four on that for like, you know, $13-14. It's not food.
It's not.
It's not sustainable. It's not healthy. But if you're trying to put food on the table,
what can you do?
Yeah.
I can caught me off guard, right? You got me thinking about Walmart and McDonald's now and a bunch of food. So now that we're on the topic of food, mm-hmm. I mean, corn. I know this is probably out of your field, but what do you think about right now? Just how the FDA and just the food industry is in the United States. I mean, almost everything, we try not to put sugar, but almost everything has corn syrup. Mm-hmm. I think we're the third or second largest producer mm-hmm. of corn products and distributor yeah. in the world. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously, you know, technically, we're not even supposed to be eating corn, even right. maize, actually. Right. Because it's not a fat that, you know, the body actually digests.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely digests, right? So it does digest. So there's several things there.
Okay.
Right? There's several things there. Where to start? One is that really, you know, since maize were the foundation, again, I'm taking your contemporary question. I'm moving it back quickly.
Okay.
As a historian, I have to do it that way. maize is the foundation of civilization in the so-called civilization in the Americas. Right? Uh-huh. It's Mesoamerica is where it emerged and fed populations for hundreds, for thousands of years. In fairly sustained ways, and in the process, right through study and through analysis and through trial and error, right, scientists, I'm going to call them scientists in Mexico, largely right, indigenous women figured out how to produce maize and find it and create it in such a way to stimulate proteins and stimulate a lot of its nutritional value. And that's through the question of that's through the process of nixtamalization, right? Of taking the corn and making it into masa.
Okay.
And once you begin to do that, right, it adds a lot of vitamins and minerals that weren't there before. It also then prevents pellagra, which is a horrible disease that maize-based diet, people who eat maize-based diets only, without nixtamalization process, so it happened in Africa, it happened in Italy, going back to Italy, as you mentioned before, right? Were and even parts of the U.S. in the South, where people just ate maize, or they just ate maize as porridge in other ways, right? They would susceptible to getting pellagra, which is a vitamin deficiency that leads to the skin falling off.
Oh wow!
It's a horrible painful disease. That never happened in Mesoamerica. That's because they figured out early on that the nixtamalization process then adds all these vitamins to it that then again stimulates all kinds of things and you don't get pellagra from it. They're making many different uses of it: tortillas, tamales, multiple items. I mean, and that's through the invention, right, of indigenous Mexican women. So people never just ate maize on their own in Mesoamerica. Maybe during, but even during periods of famine, they would eat. There was tons of other. They made wide use of all kinds of things that would not be seen as foodstuffs, but that are nutritious. So when the Europeans came in the 1500s, they brought their notions of wheat. Of a wheat-based civilization, of wheat and wine being the two staples of what modern civilized people should be eating, and not pulque, right, the fermented beverage from the maguey plant, and tortillas. Those were not considered. And of course, in Mesoamerica, people always ate tortillas or maize with beans with squash, and that tri-cropping, right, had all kind of extremely important nutritional properties to the soil, but also in combination for the food itself. So it was a very, very rich plant-based diet in which to sustain people, right, in very important ways. But in this European notion of what is good food and what is eating right, right, they're bringing, again, another notion based on their views and imposing those on others, with the notion as these little Indians don't know what's right for them. Mm. They need to be, you know, they need to take the Eucharist with the wheat bread because that's the body of Christ.
Yeah.
So for a while, they'll try to give it. They'll give it to a tortilla initially, but then they'll trick them later on.
Trick them, just a wafer, just sneak it in.
Exactly. and that a lot of that has to do with, again, different chauvinisms. And in the conquest situation, there's different power differentials. And so maize gets pushed to the poor lands, but in good kind of irrigated lands, that would be what would be planted in wheat. And later on, bring cattle, because there was no cattle, right, in the Americas before. Bring a whole variety of other animals, all of which, again, are horses, all of which are terrible for the land. Sheep, because they loosen the soil, and when there's a good downpour, like there is in many parts of Mesoamerica, right, that where there's a very hard rain, it washes the good topsoil off. And so erosion, all kinds of environmental degradation occurred because of the sheep. One author has called it a plague of sheep.
Oh, wow.
And so what it does to the soil and what the soil can produce, right, it's very detrimental. And in the process, yeah, the diet of indigenous people gets pushed to the side, and through the process of colonialism, right, where they're working, what they have access to, means in many cases, yeah, that they are forced to subsist on tortillas in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, they never did that. That was not how people ate. But again, through the burdens of colonialism and the exploitation that ensues, right, they're not eating their full diet. And this notion of wheat being better, and yes, wheat may have a slightly more protein in it, and if you analyze it over time, but people never just ate corn, right? So again, this is a notion that then gets pushed, and a chauvinism that gets pushed as then truth, and as, right, correct nutrition, and gets woven into the fabric of the U.S. so that all, and even in Mexico, there are all kinds of campaigns to get people, to wean people off, as they would say, from eating maize, and instead eating wheat bread. And of course, then, you know, the French bakers come, yeah, and the Spanish bakers come, and then we talk about bolillos and all kinds of a French bread that now, and we had here earlier,
yeah, you had
pan dulce, and all that is kind of French bread,
yeah,
and French baking. Because the notion is, well,
which, by the way, I was not expecting that to be here when I walked in. I was like, whoa.
Well, we had class before, and so there was some left. and it's dangerous having there because I eat a lot of it. But there's a notion of, yeah, the wheat is better. And again, that's not the case. Again, it's what has been preferred by the European bourgeoisie, and then passed on and then inculcated in us in the United States as a middle class healthy foodstuff. But in reality,
it's not.
However, corn and maize grows abundantly. It grew abundantly going back to the 20th and 21st century, right, in the Midwest, and through a variety of political machinations, beginning the New Deal, subsidizing farmers, right, became a very important function of the U.S. government.
Well, subsidizing corn and starches specifically.
Right, exactly. Specifically those, right, those farmers. And in the process, then it becomes very difficult, of course, to reduce those subsidies.
Yeah.
And so the result is we're in a wash with corn. There's so much corn being that has been artificially produced in the U.S. That a lot of it was just stored and sometimes dumped and when given as food aid, and of course, that's problematic too, because that's oftentimes a dumping and destroys the next crop that comes in because the price drops so low. But again, there's a variety of things there. But by keeping it, then, yeah, they have to find other ways of using it. And there you go, the creation of the finding out using corn to produce corn syrup and a and I don't know, hundreds of other things as well, yeah. since corn is in almost everything we eat. But a lot of that has to do with, again, that artificial subsidization process that goes on, in which, you know, corn is still remains heavily subsidized, even despite the World Trade Organization.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with the... They're trying to limit that expansion, or
well, I mean, in theory, one shouldn't be right. In this new global, there should not be, but there's strong lobby in the farm states.
Yeah.
Again, even though most small farmers have already kind of been pushed out, but on top of that, then Cargill and ADM, right, who are producing and are storing and then selling this grain, right, have a very strong hold in U.S. society.
Mm-hmm.
So Archer Daniels Midland then, yeah, can influence senators and Senator Obama and President Obama. And can, you know, they have strong influence. Archer Daniels Midland, for a long time, used to advertise themselves as the supermarket to the world.
I mean, would you say that, I mean, on a global aspect and for the betterment or proposed betterment of everybody else, mm-hmm. is it better just to keep companies away from expansion? Obviously, we can't do that. I mean, how do we prevent this? Or how do we, not that we prevent globalization, but prevent the actual colonization mm-hmm. of countries and their citizens?
You know, in this world that's been created, it's very difficult to do, right? And mm-hmm. and it's difficult and
some would say impossible once you got that.
Once you got it, you
going,
have it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It, again, we'll see if it's impossible, but it's extremely difficult because you're right. I mean, the countries are countries and leaders of countries then, and even individuals are forced to sell themselves on the open market and find the best way to sell themselves, right? Find their comparative advantage, whether it's land, whether it's selling it, right? And usually those are very short-term decisions. I mean, because of the need of the inequality that's here, it can't be planned over a long time. That yes, we'll slowly phase in a movement towards producing this product. That takes a lot of capital and a lot of investment and a lot of planning. And that's really kind of antithetical to the system.
Yeah.
It's antithetical.
Yeah.
And so it is very difficult in this stage. On the other hand, you know, this has kind of galvanized large numbers of movements throughout the world to kind of raise these issues and to begin to challenge what's been happening and not just kind of in a local way, which is in the past, but getting groups to begin to organize in a large
internationally
sense. Internationally and nationally and then internationally. So so going back to the Mexico case we've been talking about, you know, it was not coincidence that in January 1st, 1994, the Zapatistas in Chiapas rose up, indigenous Mayans, right, connected, organizing themselves, rose up and said, you know, ya basta, enough already. Why they choose that day? That was the day NAFTA was going to effect. And they knew that would mean, yeah, the corn and other goods will be flooding the market and push them out of existence. And they rose up and they challenged it. In the process, they began to organize and they took over periods of land, and they have, again, small areas that they control and that they are trying to slow down time, if you will, and say, no, we need to walk while thinking and asking questions. We can't just be rushing into things. We need to ask questions. We need to discuss it. We need to be involved. We need to democratize it.
Mm.
That it can't be made by a few people, you know, in corporate offices somewhere else, under the guise of doing what's best for everyone else. No, it's in their view, it's our way of life. We need to then be in charge of it. And so they rose up with very flimsy weapons and called attention to themselves, and they used the internet to do it.
Would you say that in a way that, and that's proof, but also this here in this country, is kind of proof where, you know, representative government has kind of failed us?
I think you're right. I think you're seeing that representative government is failing us in many different ways, and I think you see that in the movement it's been kind of seen as the movement of anger, but it's a movement of folks just not kind of buying into the system in the same mm-hmm. way. And I think you see that with youth, right? With youth and the move towards Bernie Sanders, and again, whether it's because what he's saying or how he's doing it, I think you're seeing a lot of that, and a lot of that notion of, well, yes, we're playing in the system by the system, but is the system really going to be able to absorb us and get us a job that we want, a job that we've trained for? And at the same time, this notion of a kind of a global consciousness there, and as you said, through the internet and through connecting broadly, through seeing things on TV, through traveling as well, recognizing that this impacts folks, that what we do and what we eat and how we eat, right, has this larger impact that we've been taught to ignore. We've been taught not to see. It's been made invisibilized.
And simply by circumstance. I mean, and coincidence and accidents. I mean, that's basically how we all got together. I mean, right?
The resistance and people kind of then asking and talking about it. Is that what you mean?
Well, no. I'm just saying, like, just all of us in our positions and where we are and right. where we were born
yeah.
and where we've become simply by circumstance. Mm-hmm. You know, I just was lucky enough to be born in this country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people were just lucky enough to be athletic or, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and so on.
Right.
And, you know, we didn't have a choice in it.
That's right. Well, a lot of it isn't right. A lot of our choices made by other people.
Yeah.
on our behalf, generally. Right. For what's yeah. good for us, in quotes.
Just reinforcing, yeah.
As opposed to, and in the process, then, you know, yes, sending us to school to teach us what's good for us.
Mm-hmm.
But people increasingly becoming, right, connected and finding out, no, we kind of also know what's good for us. And this, yeah, is not working. And you see that with the Trump movement as well, to a certain degree.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you next is, I'm guessing you're not a big fan of Trump. Or, are you voting?
No. I think you see with Trump, and I think a lot of people have been arguing this, and I think, you know, and I think rightly so. Trump is kind of a what?
Reality TV show.
Well, it's a reality TV show, but at the same time, he has all the trappings, right, of an early fascist leader. Right, playing to the anger, in quotes. But yet not kind of addressing, right, what the issues are involved in. That is why people are not finding jobs, why the people are feeling like they had no control over their lives, right? He's not looking systemically, he's deflecting.
Mm-hmm.
It's Muslims, right? We have to cut the Muslims out, right? It's the Mexicans, right? Classically using scapegoating tactics,
mm-hmm.
diversionary scapegoating tactics in that way, and then manipulating folks in that process, right? Talking, no, it's not about Wall Street. Oh, it's about some parts of Wall Street, but it's not. And so there's a harsh populist rhetoric there, but there's no discussion of the overall system, right? A systemically, how it's created in this way, and therefore, right? It's about pitting people against each other. It's about a narrow notion of nationalism. It's about a lot of violence.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, I'm not a pro Republican or, well, I mean, not pro Donald Trump, mm-hmm. but definitely, I mean, I look at the Democrats and I look at Hillary Clinton, who's proposed to be the nominee,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, she's a system. She is the equation of the system, mm-hmm. In its classic form. And then I look at Bernie Sanders, who, even though he's very what I hope to be altruistic, mm-hmm. but also, man, he doesn't really have much of the answers either. Mm-hmm. He has a lot of good ideas, mm-hmm. But nothing. You know, the devil's in the details.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they try to pinpoint him on, you know, an actual explanation on how to achieve, you know, free education or universal healthcare or other topics, you know, he deflects and kind of says the same rhetoric that Obama did in 08, which was, you know, it's the people we need to. And even though that may be true at a certain level, it's almost like the campaign itself is selling, you know, the same chant, you know, yes, we can and change.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. I remember the last part. So I think you're right. So I think with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, right? Those are, that is the American establishment, right? To a certain degree, it's not necessarily the establishment party for Trump, but he is, as he so much says, it's the establishment. I mean, this is the 1%.
Yeah,
it's the 1%. Who both have taken advantage of the system and used it for their benefit, in all cases, right? In a variety of ways, through tax loopholes, tons of different ways. And of course, Hillary Clinton is a product of it, right? And is able to and so they are both also extremely good politicians.
Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton?
No, I'm not talking about Bernie Sanders yet, but just Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
Oh, okay.
They're both extremely shrewd politicians. They move to where they feel they need to make the niche. I don't know what they believe necessarily. That's not clear. Although they'll say it with passion, but they move to where they need to go in a pragmatic way. And I think you see this with Trump. Well, from again his not too long ago support of so-called liberal causes, to now, you know, ignoring those.
It's funny they don't call him a flip flopper.
No, because he just changes his mind. And then also he says no, I never said that. And then they'll show it to him.
I would said that to Rosie O'Donnell. Not
exactly. And then that doesn't hurt him.
Yeah.
Because he's. Again, for whatever reason, because also he's given tons of free media exposure. Anything he says, he's given free media exposure, as opposed to, well, anyway. So they are very shrewd politicians, and they're good at exploiting situations and are chameleon like in their way. There's no doubt then why they are. You know
where they are,
but where they are, and also where they are both very much disliked, right? There's a large negative sentiment towards them. I think it was 61% of people had negative feelings towards, and Hillary wasn't far behind.
Yeah, it was like 49, 40. Yeah,
okay, right. Significant still, right? If those are the solutions, then there's a lot to be desired, and you can see why people. Sanders, on the other hand, right? Yeah, I think as you say, talking about this has good ideas, and I would argue from reading the plans and like lays out how it could be and what could be done. However, right, the structure of the United States government is such that it really is a conservative structure. It's not meant to allow much change, right? It's very difficult to change much. I mean, that's how the founders created it, because they were protecting their wealth and they were protecting their power. And to do that, you need stability. And so when you have that gridlock as we've been having, right, it's even much more difficult. And I think what Sanders has been saying, and again, I would agree with them, is that these are large traditions we've been talking about, large structures, large things in which the vast majority of people have had no say, have not been brought into the conversation, and that in order to address these issues, we should be brought into the conversation. And so what he's saying, I think, the way I read it, is that he's saying the only way, and you're right, Obama said a bit of this as well, but then he disbanded the troops, so to speak, you know, okay, thank you very much. I'll take care of him here. And then he went along in his merry conservative kind of way. Not rock the boat too much, right? Do some things here, talk good rhetoric. But whereas Sanders, I think, has actually said it. When he says we need the people, it's not clear to me he doesn't mean we need to keep mobilizing the people. That is, we need, again, whether people are mobilized or not, we need to have folks out in the streets, and again, in a figurative way, that is mobilizing to be able to that's the only way, right, these things can occur. It's the only way you're going to be able to restructure the tax brackets. Because because with Citizens United and other, you know that they're going that the 1% is protecting their interests. It's going to do all they can to protect their interests. So that there's very little room for change in the U.S. system.
So,
and that's why we see it leaking. That's why we see so many people, you know, not going to vote, but the vast majority staying home.
Yeah.
Even in these races where again there's excitement, it's still not turning out the vast majority of folks.
Well, even Obama, I think, only pulled out what 40, somewhere in the 40s percent, maybe even less.
Right, and even a lot of these primaries we're seeing even much less than that. And so. You know, there has been a historic, a growing, but I think the system was kind of built in that way. Works to disaffect people, and again, I think with the media and the growing conglomeration of the media, and even with social media and everything going on the internet, still there is still a driving by a few large companies of the media and of the discussion, so that all we hear on CNN and Fox and MSNBC and anywhere else, really, NPR, and again, if we listen to, you know, if we listen to some other stuff, kind of, and blogs, we get a little more complex discussion. But in that mass media, all you hear is, well, the race is over, right? It's a horse race. Who has a path? He doesn't have a path. She has a path, right? The real discussions, the real issues are sometimes talked about, but it's all about predicting a horse race. And the 24-hour news cycle feeds that. You want to turn it on to see what horrible thing, what happened, what ridiculous thing did Trump say. And then, of course, all they're doing is focusing on Trump. So anytime he's going to speak, right, he's focused. I don't know, the Daily Show, Trevor, I can never say his last name.
John Oliver?
No, on The Daily Show.
Trevor Noah.
Trevor Noah had, and Amy Goodman had a similar kind of discussion on Democracy Now! Earlier, is, yeah, that how after this last Super Tuesday, those three news outlets showed everyone else's speech but Sanders. And when they were waiting to go to Donald Trump and Sanders was speaking, they just had they had the image of waiting for Donald Trump to speak, and they didn't go to Sanders, and they went to all those folks, even the folks like Kasich who only won one, and Rubio and all these folks haven't won anything. But Sanders, right? That discussion doesn't happen because that horse race is already done. Well, right? There's no reason why there's no. I mean, it's no wonder why people are. Yeah, disaffected, because you hear this stuff over and over again, and there's no real opportunity for change within the structure.
Yeah. I know we're running out of time, but let me just ask you a real quick question. Probably it's not a really quick question, but it's an article that you wrote, actually, back in 2009, and I just wanted to get your opinion, because I know a lot has changed since this article. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to get your input as a teacher who works here at Cal State LA, mm-hmm. and as for me, who actually came here and graduated, it's called an article, "The Silent Unraveling of the CSU," mm-hmm. and quote, "As administrators restructure the university without public knowledge and public debate, they may be creating a second-class institution that does not meet the social, economic, and educational needs of Californians." Something you kind of touched on at the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. That was in 2009, and back then there was, I think, a 30% increase in just in general California mm-hmm. institutions. I mean, has it gotten better here? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you see students getting a better education? Do you feel like, I mean, you're part of the Latin American Studies. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're getting the support? Is it getting better?
Right. Okay. So that can go in a couple different. So let me go take it a couple different ways. First of all, right, the Cal States are definitely a place where one can get a first class education. I think what we do here, can't be matched in many other places. In the sense that, right, small classes. We have relatively small classes. You can go to the UCs and have same class that I teach here with 35 or 40 students. I think the class you were in was maybe 35 or about 40.
Yeah, something like 30.
Would be at least 90. mm-hmm. or if not more, right? And I grade your papers, and we're involved, and we can discuss that we have that at the Cal States, right? Which we don't have, and we're very lucky to. Mm-hmm. And there's a variety of classes. That being said, right, there's been over the past 40 years in California a disinvestment in public higher education.
Yeah.
Right, and that correlates with the rapid the investment and building of prisons in California. Right, there you can see the bar graphs, and they pass each other as prison expenditure goes up, and the number of prisons being built goes up, and the number of CSUs might go down. And so there's been a kind of a disinvestment, and usually in the context of economic crisis. And when there's economic crisis, yes, it goes down, the amount coming in goes down. But there's also been a restructuring, and that's what that article refers to, kind of a neoliberal restructuring that's going on, that's prioritizing the market, that's fundamentally arguing that students should be paying their own way, that we no longer should be investing in students as the future of California. They should pay their own way, and that really there should be management solutions. And so we've seen a growth in management up mm-hmm. top, and we've seen a growing casualization of labor below, so to speak. So the professors, right, so that at least half of the professors in the Cal State are on temporary contracts. They don't have tenure, they don't have stability, are hired on class by class basis, and that number, even as the budget's improved, it hasn't changed. It's gotten worse, actually. Mm. At the same time, administrative salaries, the numbers of administrators, that grows. So in 2000, it took 300, I'm trying to think of the number exactly, but it's about 350 hours of minimum wage work to pay for fees and tuition for 1 year of college.
At Cal State LA?
At all the Cal States.
Okay.
Looking at fees and tuition, right? As of this year, 2015-16, it takes 780 hours of minimum wage work to pay 1 year's tuition. Jeez. So 780 hours, right, is equivalent to working 15 hours a week for about 50 weeks of the year in order to pay 1 year of tuition. And mind you, right, that number is higher because the minimum wage has gone up to $10 an hour.
Yeah.
Right? But so if I did the same number 5 years before, it would be up to 800. It would take 800 hours.
Jeez.
So right there tells you this investment, right, that's there. It's that we're not investing in it, even though we know all the economic studies show the return we get on the investment, not to mention the social and the cultural and the civic.
Yeah.
Value of a university education. So that's not happening. And in the process, right, we're seeing, stagnant salaries throughout. So you're asking this question at a really opportune time, because in 3 weeks I'll be on strike. On April 13th, we've declared a statewide strike of the CSU. Of the CSU faculty of all 23 campuses.
Oh wow, I had no idea.
And it is really about our larger fight to preserve the CSU, and to restructure it as what many of us see it and always knew it to be, beginning in 1960 when my parents met here in 1963, as a people's university where working class families whose parents weren't able to send them to college, who weren't able to go to college before, are now able to send them to college because the state of California says anyone who wants an education should be able to get an education regardless of means. And therefore, the state made that investment. They created a three-tier structure, which is problematic in the hierarchy, but nevertheless, right, said that anyone who wanted to should be able to.
Well, they also converted it. Well, at least here, you guys are no longer on the quarter system, right?
Right. Now we'll be on the semester system next semester.
Oh, next semester.
And in part, that again is a management decision based on ability to manage the 23 systems together. So again, it's about management tinkering above as opposed to letting people kind of decide their own and say, well, semesters might be good in a lot of different ways, and I'm not against them necessarily. However, I knew that my students, right, the students here, if they couldn't pay for some reason, which is very common, they could take one quarter off and come back the next quarter and still get more, and be able to get more units. Whereas now they have to take this whole semester off, and then that'll delay the amount of time to graduation. Again, whether the semester is better or not, to me, is not the answer. It's who was consulted in that discussion, and what real conversations were had.
Well, I know that this place in particular, and I was one of them, spoke against switching it over. One of the main reasons for me even coming here was because of that. Mm-hmm. And it was hard for me working full time and going to school,
right,
and just knowing, damn. You know, just a year from now, mm-hmm, people are going to lose that small snitch of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And now it, what would have been, you know, just 4 months off, you're talking about six.
That's right.
And it just crescendos like a, mm-hmm, like interest, you
That's
know?
That's right. Well, but now what could happen, though, and this is the argument, too, it'll also be about financing. Now they can create a three to four week intercession in the winter. And let's see if they're not going to charge the state rate. They're going to charge the rate, the self-sustaining rate, which means the actual cost of what it would be. So they'll charge more during those, and they're in the summer session. And so yes, you could take more classes and get through. However, they're going to be not that expensive. I mean, they're going to be still way too expensive, and they're going to be much more expensive during those summer times.
Wow.
Right? That's the business model we're thinking of, as opposed to making the public case of why this is value, right? And so administrators are more there about figuring out how to raise more money, as opposed to, again, like going to the legislature, yes, and also being creative in raising money, but recognizing that there's a value to business of the CSU, and of course business makes that argument as well. Right, there's a value to all our society to have a system where we all can profit from, and the CSU has been that people's university, as you just said, right? People working full time, raising families, doing a bunch of other things, yet being able to carve that out. Well, increasingly we know, right? The encouragement is no, maybe that should be done by the for-profit sector, by, you know, University of Phoenix or by DeVry. Or by, right, these other schools, as
which are all under lawsuit by the Department of Justice.
Of course, because of course they need to have it paid as well, and they know their schemes of getting financial aid. Yeah, so I mean, so that's a problem. So on the one hand, I would say, you know, I mean, this is where I've decided. I mean, I've consciously chosen to live my life and to dedicate my career and my here at Cal State for students just like, right, you were and others, to be able to develop connections with and learn from students who come from different walks of life, who see things in different ways, who raise questions that I wouldn't, who challenge me in the classroom and challenge what I say, just like you did, so we can have profitable kind of dialogues where we can understand each other and learn about other points of view and then shift in some ways, right? That's really what's exciting. But to see year after year the difficulty people face and not being able to afford tuition. There was a recent CSU study that was commissioned by the chancellor that says 1 in 4, and it's probably higher, but 1 in 4 students is food insecure.
Yeah.
And of course that, well, yeah, you think that makes sense, right? That that doesn't surprise you. You just said, yeah. And that's shocking in the wealthiest country in the world. But it makes sense because the tuition is rising, the job security is difficult, right? We've been seeing shifts there. So yeah, it makes sense. And
we're
and
all just stretched out.
And then we're stretched and we're stressed, as you said. Yeah. Right? And that's not a healthy society. That's not the markings of a healthy society.
Man, I wish I could keep going. I know you got class.
Yeah, no, it was great. But
I mean, I enjoy talking to you. And I mean, hopefully I can get back with
sure,
you
definitely.
For another topic, probably more time. But definitely, I think everybody listening to this benefited a lot.
Great. Well, I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad you're doing it. Yeah, keep up the good work.
All right. And that's it, you freaks. I just want to thank Dr. Ochoa for coming on to the podcast and, you know, giving me the time to interview him. Just it took a little bit of scheduling, but we got in there. So also, I just want to thank you guys, the listeners. It's always good to hear good feedback from one of the interviews, or, you know, just hearing a concept that we talk about, whether we're, you know, really into it or we're really just completely plastered. So always glad to hear we're some sort of benefit. And, you know, always remember you can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, and YouTube, and you can also subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher. I think we're on Blueberry. I don't know anymore. But check all of those things out, and check out the website abspodcast.com, where, you know, you get to look at all our episodes, subscribe, and help support the show. Also, you know, if you guys have any questions, suggestions, just email me at anotherbspodcast@gmail.com. All right, guys, have a good weekend. Bye.